Hello everyone, and thanks for joining us for this latest in our series of Employment Espresso Pods. I'm Nick Wright, a partner in our London Employment Law team, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by Anna Henderson. Anna is a professional support consultant who usually works behind the scenes, making sure the team is up to speed on the often fast-paced developments that happen in our corner of the legal world. Anna, delighted to have you on stage today.
Thanks very much, Nick. Hello, everyone.
So today's topic is some important changes to the law around redundancy. And many of those are coming into force at the start of the new tax year on 6th of April. Now, the basics of redundancy processes in the UK have been the same for some time. And we find that many managers are very confident when they head into the process. However, as we all know, degree of comfort can also bring a degree of danger, and there are now some changes coming in that could prove to be traps for the unwary. So we're going to unpick those for you today and give you some thoughts on things to look out for if, unfortunately, you are having to think about redundancies in your business. Anna, would you mind taking us through the changes, please?
Of course, Nick. So just to set the scene, the changes that we're talking about are concern the later part of a redundancy process. So it's once you've already identified that you've got a redundancy situation, you've got your sensible selection pool, you've come up with a list of objective non-discriminatory criteria, you've applied them fairly, and you've got your list of provisionally redundant employees. And as I'm sure our listeners will know, it's then a requirement of fairness that you look for alternative jobs that you can offer to those individuals, both within your own employer organisation, but also within the wider group of associated companies. And it's at that point that certain categories of employee get additional protection. And it is this that's actually changing and being expanded in April. So under the current law, if you've got any of your employees that are provisionally selected as redundant whilst they are on maternity, adoption or shared parental leave, they get priority to be redeployed into any suitable vacancies that you've identified in preference to everybody else.
Thanks, Anna. So point to draw out there is that currently and indeed in the future, there's no legal restriction or bar to making someone on those types of family leave redundant as a concept if their role is redundant. It's more that they have an enhanced right when it comes to considering if there are any suitable alternative vacancies.
Yeah, yes, that's absolutely right. And obviously the change that's happening from April is a change to that protection. So it's going to be expanded to provide employees with a longer period of protection when they've got a new family. So it's going to go all the way through from pregnancy through to a period post-family leave. So just looking at that in a little more detail, the types of employee who will be covered. So firstly, you have any pregnant employee, they're going to be protected once they've informed their employer that they are pregnant on or after the 6th of April, and they're protected throughout their pregnancy. If unfortunately they suffer a pregnancy loss before they reach the 24-week gestation point, they're then protected for a further 2 weeks after that pregnancy loss. The existing coverage that's already in place for employees remains. So the employees who are on maternity, adoption or shared parental leave, they're still protected. And it's just worth mentioning here that those who suffer a pregnancy loss after 24 weeks are also entitled to maternity leave. So they are also protected in that way. And then there's also this new additional protected period after family leave. So protection will last through until 18 months after the birth or adoption of the child. And that will be available to individuals who've returned from maternity or adoption leave on or after the 6th of April, or those who have taken at least 6 consecutive weeks of shared parental leave starting on or after the 6th of April.
Thanks, Anna. And I think one of the things we've seen discussion about in the market is around this slightly nebulous concept of someone who informs their pregnancy on or after 6th of April, and you know, some people querying if the employee needs to re-inform their employer. And you know, obviously that would be the cautious thing to do, although you know, hopefully in practice, if someone's already informed their employer of their pregnancy, I can't see many employers looking to take the point that they need to be told again after 6th of April. And frankly, there should then be further discussion around arrangements for maternity leave, which probably meets the threshold anyway. The rules are obviously quite detailed. Anna, are you able to sort of give us your views on the main implications for employers and the key things they need to think about?
Yeah, well, I think the first challenge actually for HR is going to be making sure they've got an accurate list who is actually protected at any point in time. So you're going to need accurate records of notification of pregnancy, bearing in mind, as you just said, that there are no formal requirements for that. You're going to need to know the dates of any unfortunate pregnancy loss. You're going to need leave dates and so on. And you're going to need to make sure those are all up to date. And I think on that front, it might be as well, so some employers may want to amend the various family leave policies they've got to try and encourage people to notify HR as well as their line managers of those dates to try and make it easier, although that won't necessarily be a requirement of them having the protection. I think the second point is that obviously with more categories of protected employees, there are going to be more occasions when you've got protected employees being provisionally selected for redundancy. So I think it's all the more important that managers are fully aware of the extended rights. I think they need to understand that they can't just give a vacancy to their preferred candidate for a role. And that may be a bit unwelcome to some managers. And I think also they're going to need to be able to explain sensitively what's going on, what the position is to the other at-risk employees who obviously are not going to be given the chance to apply for a vacancy if it's being prioritised for someone returning from leave, for example. And I think the third point perhaps is that, again, obviously it's going to be more common that there isn't enough suitable vacancies for all the protected employees you've got. And what do you do then? So if you've got one vacancy that's suitable for two or more protected employees, how do you choose between them? Sadly, the law doesn't actually give us any guidance on that. There is some guidance from ACAS that was published back in 2018, so before these changes. And that simply suggests that when you've got this situation of more than one protected employee and just one vacancy, the employer's got to consider who is most suitable for the vacancy, which obviously is not terribly helpful. I think it wouldn't surprise me if we get some case law on this point at some point in the future. But in the meantime, I guess the advice really is, first of all, ask if any of your employees want to volunteer to take the redundancy. If not, you're probably going to need to do a new selection process for the role that you've got. And it might be that the same criteria that you used for the first round are appropriate to use again, but that might not be the case, depending on what the role is. So I think you're going to need to think that through. One thing you don't want to do is simply give the vacancy to the person who's coming back to work first from leave. That may well be the most helpful thing to do from a business perspective, but obviously that could give rise to potential claims. And I think just a sort of final thought is that obviously employees who get wind of coming redundancy plans, they may well choose to notify their pregnancy very early on in their pregnancy, or they might decide to take a longer period of shared parental leave than they were going to, simply to ensure that they get the extended protection. That might be annoying to some managers. It's something that is understandable that employees might want to do. They're entitled to do it. And so it might be sensible to remind managers that they shouldn't be treating employees who do that worse for that reason.
Absolutely, Anna. And I think that really goes back to the point around what this protection is. It's a right to a suitable alternative vacancy if there is one available. And of course, in lots of situations, there may not be. You know, if, for example, if you're shutting down a particular division, a location, for example, there just may not be any other jobs in that area. It's more likely to arise perhaps if you're restructuring a function to perhaps change the way it's modelled. But even then, if the skills you need or the terms and conditions of employment are markedly different, then it may not be that the vacancy is suitable, and therefore there may not actually be any impact on the process. As you're drawing out, the main thing that I think some guidance would be really helpful on is in a situation where you have a number of employees with protection, you know, the law is going means, or the, these changes to the law mean the chances of there being multiple employees with this protection in larger redundancy exercises is far higher than it has been in the past.
Yeah.
And there is no difference between the respective rights of the people with protection. If you're protected, you have the right. And unfortunately, without any guidance, it's hard for employers to navigate that, because they'll want to do the right thing, but it's very difficult to know exactly what that right thing is without some further guidance. So I think that's the number one practical question mark in my mind when employers are faced with this situation. Mm. And let's say they have a go and it goes wrong. What are the risks that they face?
So if you've got an employer who's found to have failed to offer a suitable alternative to a protected employee, basically the employee can bring an automatically unfair dismissal claim. So normally for unfair dismissal claims, you need 2 years service. Because this is a different type, it's an automatically unfair dismissal claim. You don't need those 2 years service. You can bring that claim however long you've been working. Although I would note that the statutory cap on compensation for unfair dismissal does still apply to those types of claim. But then on the other hand, depending on the facts, you might also, of course, be facing a discrimination claim. And as I'm sure our listeners know, compensation for discrimination is not subject to any cap. So there could potentially be a sizable sort of loss of earnings claim arising from it.
Thanks, Anna. That's really helpful. Should we move on to the second development we wanted to cover? And that's an EAT ruling, which actually came out at the end of last year, called the Bank Haycox. Anna, do you mind starting by giving us a brief summary of the facts?
Thanks, Nick. Of course, I'm sure our listeners are well aware that under the Trade Union Labour Relations Consolidation Act, which has been around for a long time now, you have to do collective consultation when you're proposing 20 or more redundancies at one establishment within a 90-day period. And that is, you're talking there about consultation with union reps if you've got them. If you haven't, then with either existing or specifically elected employee reps. And it's got to cover things like avoiding or how to avoid or reduce dismissals if you can, and how to mitigate the consequences. So that applies to the sort of larger scale redundancies. But for smaller scale ones under that 20 threshold, those collective consultation rules don't apply. So the focus has always been on consulting with the individual employees who've been provisionally selected. And that is mainly going to be about the application of the selection criteria to them and the possible vacancies, as we've just been talking about. So that's to sort of set the scene. In this particular case in Haycox, we had a claimant who was one of a team of 16 individuals whose workload had halved and who therefore were potentially at risk of redundancy. And the employer scored them against criteria without doing any prior consultation. Claimant was then provisionally selected because he scored lowest. And only then was he invited to meetings to discuss the situation, which all sounds sort of relatively normal. The tribunal at first instance held that his dismissal was fair. But what's significant is the EAT disagreed. So in its view, employers obviously have to act within the band of reasonableness. And it thought for these purposes, that meant employers following good industrial relations practice. And they thought that a key element of that is meaningful consultation at the formative stage of a redundancy process. So in other words, before you have provisionally selected people. And the purpose of that consultation should be basically allowing employees an opportunity to propose ways of avoiding the redundancies or to give their thoughts about the process that the employer is suggesting at a time when they can actually influence the employer's actions. And the EAT thought that applies to small scale redundancies just as much as to large ones covered by TULCRA, the 1992 Act. So in this particular case, because there was nothing in the tribunal's decision suggesting that the employer had good reasons for not consulting at this formative stage of the process, it therefore ruled that the dismissal was unfair. Just to note on this before we talk about it further is that the employer has actually been given permission to appeal the decision to the Court of Appeal. They're due to hear it by the end of March 2025, so the position could well change in the future.
Well, we better keep an eye out for that appeal, hopefully not too long to wait now, what do you see as the implications in the short term?
I think the takeaway from this decision is probably that employers should at the very least consider whether to consult and possibly at a workforce level at the sort of earlier formative stage of redundancy proposals. Think about consulting about the proposal and the process and think about whether you can do it at a workforce level or not. I think if the decision is taken, and we'll come on to look at when why that might be the case, that it's not appropriate to consult at such an early stage, then I think it's always going to be sensible to have a paper trail to show that you have at least considered it and that you have, you know, that you've noted down the reason why you've decided not to do it. I think that's going to be helpful at the very least.
Thanks, Anna. I think that raises several questions. In particular, what might be a good reason not to consult in this way? I think our experience is that clients are often not keen to raise these proposals more widely because they don't want to cause anxiety to employees. So they wait until the provisional selection has taken place and they can actually speak to the individuals that are actually at risk. Further, I think where, and this often happens actually, you know, the redundancy is very limited and might impact a small handful of employees, perhaps only very senior employees, then confining discussions to individual consultation often gives the parties maximum flexibility of managing the situation in a way that's perhaps least impactful on the employee. So I think you've got to question whether it is right in the circumstances, and I'd hope tribunals would take that into account. Any views on whether those might be passable reasons?
The difficulty is that we don't really get much guidance from the EAT decision as to what a good reason could be. The only thing they seem to suggest sort of implicitly is that time pressures might be a good reason to not consult at the formative stage in some cases. My concern is that it could be said that, you know, a desire to avoid upset to the rest of the workforce is going to be the case in every single redundancy program, and therefore that shouldn't be enough. I mean it's going to be quite fact specific. There are undoubtedly going to be cases where I would have thought tribunals might be persuadable that, you know, that consulting more widely would be exceptionally disruptive or simply sort of counterproductive. It's difficult at this point to give any sort of clear guidance because the EAT itself hasn't done so. And I think obviously, no doubt the case is, you know, if it's upheld on appeal, I suspect we'll see further cases testing this particular point. Obviously, if it's overturned on appeal, then we can all breathe a sigh of relief.
Yeah, no, thanks, Anna. And how about any guidance on how consultations should take place and perhaps who with?
Okay, so again, the ruling isn't terribly helpful. What it says is that one option would be large-scale workforce meetings, so things like town halls, but it doesn't want to be, the EAT said it didn't want to be prescriptive about how it's done. So that obviously leaves open the possibility that other forms of consultation might be reasonable, again, depending on the particular circumstances. So it might be worth thinking about, you know, could it be a reasonable compromise just to send communications about the proposal to your redundancy selection pool, for example, you know, telling them what the selection criteria are going to be. Obviously, it depends on the size of them, whether that's going to be sensible or not. And then sort of inviting them to giving them the opportunity to comment through some particular channel and then sort of, you know, giving a commitment that you will genuinely consider those comments and responding to them in some way. That might be enough. But as I say, the EAT decision itself is not terribly helpful on this either.
Okay. Well, the more I hear about it, the more I think this is probably one of those that has to be considered on a case-by-case basis, depending on what the existing modus operandi is. Not necessarily say that is therefore right, but, you know, what works within the business, who's impacted, you know, what kind of consultation process on an individual basis is envisaged, etc., etc. So I'm hopeful, like you, that the tribunals will look at these on a case-by-case basis. I suppose the other point is, even if a failure to collectively consult in the small c or a non-tulcra sense does lead to a claim, one would assume that compensation would be pretty limited, actually, wouldn't you? You could argue something akin to Polky, that, you know, if you had done a little more consultation, that would have taken 2 weeks more, but the outcome would have been no different, and therefore any compensation should be limited to the salary that would have been paid for those 2 weeks. Does that sound a runnable argument to you, Anna?
Yeah, absolutely right, I think. And of course, the other point is that if you are offering an enhanced redundancy package, you know, in return for a settlement agreement, then the issue may simply disappear, because you just you're agreeing the departure and the possibility of claims is waived.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, in most cases, an enhanced package is usually conditional on a settlement agreement. So as you say, hopefully everyone can get finality and move on from the situation.
Yeah.
Right. On that note, I think we're out of time for today. Anna, thank you very much for taking us through those changes. And to our listeners, if you would like to hear more on those topics, we have a briefing paper that covers them both and also looks at some other things on the horizon, such as the fire and rehire code, which as I speak is awaiting parliamentary approval. If you'd like to see a copy of that briefing, please do get in touch.
And the other thing just to mention, Nick, is you can obviously also subscribe to our blog on our website, hsf.com, which will keep you up to date with other developments on redundancy and other topics too.
Absolutely, do give it a look. Right, until next time, thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.